Chris. And who is he, anyway? When I look up from my string of push-ups, I ponder the man wearing a green pointy hat that makes him look like a life-sized garden gnome. A bushy beard frames his piercing blue eyes and ruddy nose, and his body bristles with tightly corded muscles. Hoff is nothing less than a savant and a madman, a prophet and a foil. And as is occasionally the case with people who try to cultivate superpowers, Hoff's abilities come at a heavy price. A foot-long surgical scar arcs across his stomach and marks a time that his training landed him in an Amsterdam hospital in a fight for his life. Born in the Dutch city of Sittard in 1959 on the eve of Europe's hippie revolution, Hoff spent his early years in the middle of a working-class family of 9 children. While the rest of the Hoff family learned Catholic liturgy, Wim became fascinated with Eastern teachings, memorizing parts of Patanjali's Yoga Sutras and scouring the Bhagavad Gita and the teachings of Zen Buddhism for wisdom. He was keen on exploring the connections between the body and the mind, but none of what he read was quite what he was looking for. Then, in the winter of 1979, when he was 20 years old, he found it. While walking alone on a frosty morning in Amsterdam's picturesque Beatrix Park, he noticed a thin skin of ice on one of the canals. He wondered what it would feel like if he jumped in. With a juvenile impulsiveness that he has never quite shed, he took off his clothes and plunged in naked. The shock was immediate, he says, but the feeling wasn't of cold. It was something like a tremendous good. I was in the water only a minute, but time just slowed down. It felt like ages. A wash of endorphins cruised through his system, and the high lasted through the afternoon. He has gone on to repeat the exercise just about every day since. Cold is my teacher, he says. The breathing technique emerged naturally. He started by mimicking the rapid breaths that people take instinctively when they plunge into icy water, which he says are similar to the breaths that a woman takes during childbirth. In both cases, the body switches to an instinctual program. When Hoff dunked under the ice, his body went from natural rapid breathing to a breath hold. That's when he began to feel changes in his body. The way Hoff explains it, humans must have evolved with an innate ability to resist the elements. Our remote ancestors marched across the endless expanse of frosty mountains and navigated parched deserts long before they invented even the most basic footwear or animal skin coats. While technology has made us more comfortable, the underlying biology is still there. And Hoff believes that the key to unlocking our lost potential lies in recreating the sorts of harsh experiences that our ancestors would have faced. Hoff trained on his own in obscurity for 15 years, rarely talking about his own growing abilities. His first student was his son, Anum. When Anum was still an infant, Hoff took him down to the canals and dunked him in the water, like Achilles. While it's anyone's guess what nearby pedestrians might have thought of this sight, most of his friends shrugged off his morning routines as just another eccentricity in an already eccentric city. Hoff did odd jobs, including working as a mail carrier, and took summer gigs in Spain as a canyoneering instructor. Money was always a problem, and his wife, a beautiful Basque woman named Olaya, began to show signs of a serious mental disorder. She was depressed. She heard voices. In July 1995, she jumped off the 8th floor of her parents' apartment building in Pamplona, on the first day of the running of the bulls. Sitting at a handmade wooden table in what serves as a lunchroom and breakfast nook in his Polish headquarters, Hoff recounts Olaya's death as tears freely roll down his cheeks. "Why would God take my wife from me?" he asks. Confronted with a loss and a broken heart, he put all of his faith into the one thing that set him apart from everyone else, his ability to control his body. Olaya had never shown interest in Hoff's methods, but he felt that he could have done more to help her. "The inclination that I have to train people now is because of my wife's death," he says. "I can bring people back to tranquility. Schizophrenia and multiple personality disorder draw away people's energy, but my method can give them back control. It was his call to action, but he still needed a way to announce himself to the world. His opportunity came a few years later. As winter settled in on Amsterdam, a local newspaper ran a series of articles about various odd things that people did in the snow. The paper contacted Hoff, and he explained that for the past couple of decades, he'd been skinny dipping in icy water. The paper sent a reporter, and Hoff jumped into a nearby lake that he frequented. The article ran, and the next week, a television crew showed up. In that now famous segment, Hoff cut holes in the ice and jumped in while the news crew filmed. He was drying himself off when, a few meters away, a man stepped on a thin patch and fell through. Hoff charged out into the lake, jumped in a second time, and dragged the man to safety. The news crew caught the exchange, and soon Hoff wasn't just a local oddity, he was a local hero. Someone dubbed him the Iceman, and the name stuck. After that act of heroism, Hoff became a household name across the Netherlands. A Dutch television program hosted by the eminent newscaster Willebrord Frequin asked Hoff to perform on camera. The gimmick was to have Hoff establish a Guinness Book World Record. They planned for him to swim 50 meters beneath Arctic ice without breathing. It would be sensationalist fun, but the program would air throughout Northern Europe and give Hoff a shot at doing stunts for other channels around the world. A few weeks later, Hoff stood on the surface of a frozen lake near the small village of Pello, Finland, a handful of miles from the Arctic Circle. He was wearing only a bathing suit. Although the temperature would drop to minus 12 degrees Fahrenheit, his skin glistened with sweat. Below him, a diamond-shaped hole shot down a meter through the ice. There were two other holes, 25 and 50 meters from the first. A camera crew watched as Hoff descended and dipped his toe into the periwinkle waters. On the first day of shooting, he was supposed to swim only to the first hole so that the crew could set up the right shots and feel comfortable with safety protocols. But Hoff had other plans. He wanted to surprise and impress the crew by clearing the whole distance in one go. He had done his calculations in advance. One stroke took him just over a meter, and he calculated that he would need to go 42 strokes to reach his destination. Taking a giant gulp of air into his lungs, Hoff disappeared and began his sprint. He later recalled that he opened his eyes midway between the first and second hole, and he could make out a beam of sunlight slicing through the water. But at stroke 29, with the safety of the first hole and a rescue team behind him, something went wrong. He hadn't anticipated what cold water would do to his eyes. His corneas began to freeze over, and the crystallization blurred his vision. Five strokes later, he was blinded, with only his stroke count to direct him to oxygen. Soon, he was off course. At 42 strokes, he grabbed around in vain for the rim of the second hole. He turned around, thinking maybe he'd passed it. He wanted to gasp for air, but he knew the results would be fatal. At 48 strokes, his hope was beginning to fade. 70 strokes in, just as he began to lose consciousness, he felt a hand wrap around his ankle. A safety diver dragged him to the surface. He knew he had almost died and that his hubris had led him to the brink. Despite that close call, the next day he would set a world record with the cameras rolling. The show went on to be a hit and secured Hoff a series of similar on-air stunts for international channels, from Discovery to National Geographic to Vice. They seemed to grow in proportion to one another, with each one pushing death's barrier. There was a barefoot marathon above the Arctic Circle, where the ice numbed his feet so thoroughly that his toe turned black with frostbite. The injury healed on its own despite a doctor's assessment to the contrary. When he aimed to head up Mount Everest a few months later, again with a film crew behind him, he started his ascent into worldwide media attention. His attempt to reach the summit in shorts ground to a halt at 25,590 feet, roughly 3 hours from the top of the Earth, just inside the so-called death zone that has taken the lives of at least 250 climbers. That's when his foot started to experience a familiar numbness that he'd felt in the Arctic. Rather than risk losing his foot, he turned back. Success could mean too high of a price. Although he was capable of incredible feats, Hoff's desire to impress and please the people around him time and time again have led him into near-fatal situations. Should he die, the world might never understand how he achieved such dramatic results. Hoff needed a better plan. My relationship with Hoff starts in the winter of 2013, when I climb aboard a plane from Los Angeles to Wrocław, Poland, with a magazine commission and the intention to debunk his claims. At best, I believe Hoff is a circus act who has mastered a few tricks of endurance and sleight of hand. He won't be the first false guru that I've disrobed in print. Just a few months earlier, Playboy published an article of mine about a monk in Arizona named Geshe Michael Roach, who was teaching a bastardized form of Tibetan Buddhism that allowed him to have free range over the sexual activities of some of the members of his flock. Roach promised his students that they could meditate their way into superpowers. With his own brand of training, they could learn to become invisible, read people's minds, and transform into enlightened angels. That might have been unremarkable in a world of eccentric ideologies, except that the spiritual teachings of this Lama, a Tibetan title given to master practitioners, led a young idealistic follower to meditate until he died of dehydration in the mountains above the cultic compound. The week I set off to meet Hoff is also the one in which I secure a deal to expand the article about Roach and that sordid affair into a full-fledged book that I intend to be my opus against sham spirituality. To me, Hoff seems that he is trying to use his history of carnivalesque stunts to amass gullible followers to his so-called method and empty their wallets in the process. In other words, I perceive my visit with Hoff to be a mere pit stop in my career as an investigative journalist debunking people like him. Of course, there are some formalities to get through first. The noblest ideals of journalism include hearing all sides to any story and giving sources a fair shake. If Hoff claims to have a method to consciously control parts of his body that are locked away from most people, then I can't simply write from the sidelines. Instead, I must follow his instructions and watch the claims fall apart. Over the years, I've interviewed organ traffickers, interrogated mob bosses, and been held up by child soldiers with automatic weapons. As long as I don't plunge fatally into hypothermia, this isn't the most dangerous assignment I've ever accepted. After my plane thunders into the terminal gate, Hoff meets me on the other side of baggage claim with a broad smile. He made his headquarters in Poland instead of his home in the Netherlands so that he can be closer to icy streams and snow-covered mountains, and also take advantage of a weaker economy that allowed him to purchase a larger space. We pile into a tiny gray Opel Astra with two other devotees, a Croatian and a Latvian, who've also come to study his technique. Together, we traverse miles of Polish pines and picturesque villages en route to Hoff's rural base of operations. Janusz Kuz crams next to me, and my hiking backpack overflows onto his lap. The burly Latvian grew up amid the turmoil of a collapsing Soviet Union when bandits roamed the countryside. His father stashed a loaded AK-47 beneath his son's bed. It was never more than an instant away should they have needed to defend themselves. Now, Kuz is studying the Israeli martial art of Krav Maga in his spare time and spars with his equally intimidating, and he assures me beautiful, girlfriend. Asked if he was ready to immerse himself in ice water, he replies, "When my father was in the special forces, they tested soldiers' ability to adapt by making them sit in ice water. If they survived, they passed. Not everyone passed." The Croatian, Vladimir Stojakovic, works for a mobile phone company back at home and is looking for something that might reinvigorate his office-bound life. We arrive in the tiny village of Prešeka, where Hoff owns an isolated farmhouse that he was able to purchase after signing a deal in 2011 with Columbia Sportswear to shill a line of battery-heated jackets. In the commercials, which were created for TV but thrived on the internet, Hoff swims in a frozen lake while giving icy stares to toasty outdoorsmen who use the high-tech gear to warm themselves at the touch of a button. The videos went viral, and commenters compared Hoff to Chuck Norris, propelling him to a sort of internet alpha male celebrity. But the condition of the house confirms that fame does not always translate to riches. The space is a permanent work in progress, with an assortment of bunk beds and yoga mats strewn pell-mell across two floors. A busted sauna sits next to its newer replacement, and a coal-fired furnace that doesn't quite work spews black smoke through the cracks in the floorboards. For that matter, most of the floors don't seem level. Still, the crumbling building is the headquarters for Hoff's growing global presence as a New Age guru and ground zero for the experimental training regimen he is developing. One of Hoff's first students at the house was a college student named Justin Rosales, who flew to the Netherlands from Pennsylvania in 2010 to serve as a guinea pig. "If we want to become strong, passionate, and motivated, we have to take on seemingly impossible tasks. Without an open mind, the cold will never be your friend," Rosales told me over email. He wrote and self-published a book with Hoff about his experience, entitled Becoming the Iceman. It's often passed around among devotees looking for personal transformation. I stash what little winter gear I'd brought beneath a bunk on the second floor and look out the window onto a snowy field that serves as the main training site. What I see astonishes me. I watch Andrew Laselius, the wiry, asthmatic Nebraskan who arrived a week earlier, cross the space clad only in black underwear. He stops to pick up handfuls of snow and then commences to rub them all over his arms and chest. Steam erupts off his body in great clouds. My mind tries to grasp what I'm looking at. I am simply unwilling to comprehend the unfolding scene. Is that actual steam? Kuz, who chooses a bunk next to mine, looks out at Laselius. He tells me that he is eager to get out into the snow. Somehow, the idea of getting naked in the ice excites rather than dissuades him. I let him head outside on his own. I will have plenty of opportunities to be cold in the coming week. After a restless night of sleep, I take my place with the group that gathers in the yoga studio downstairs to meet Hoff in our first official lesson. The program is still clearly in its infancy, and Hoff explains that every training session will be a little different depending on the chemistry of the group. But no matter how it starts, the building blocks are simple enough, and he assures us that our progress will be rapid. "This week, we will win the war on bacteria," he proclaims again, before warning us that he will challenge everything we ever thought about the limits of our bodies. The monologue goes on a touch too long. There's a tendency Hoff exhibits in many of his public appearances to be heavy on promises, but often light on practice. But eventually, he tells us to shed our clothing and head outside. We exit the farmhouse in our underwear and bare feet and trod onto the snowy field frequented by deer. I notice the curious gazes of inquisitive neighbors. As we file past, one of them yells something in Polish, and Hoff chuckles. Most of the people here think he's crazy, if affable. Not that I'm paying too much attention to the opinions of fully clothed Polishmen. It is the first time in my life that I've put my feet directly into the snow, and they feel as sensitive as a newly broken tooth. My heart rate jumps. Kuz lets out a gasp, while Hoff beams a trickster smile. We stand in a circle and take low horse stances, a wide-legged posture derived from Asian martial arts that resembles the position of a person riding a horse. The goal is simple: to focus our minds on our foreheads and simply endure the cold with our chests bare to the air. 5 minutes is excruciating, but Hoff has us stand there for six before sending us numbly into the sauna. With numb legs, going from a snowy field into a 100-plus-degree sauna feels like a sensational mistake. The pain is even worse than standing in the snow, something that I could not have imagined was possible. The body's natural reaction to cold is self-preservation. To keep the core warm, The muscles that control the veins clench tightly and restrict the flow of blood only to vital areas. The process is known as vasoconstriction. This is why frostbite starts in the extremities. The lack of blood flow to those areas makes them cool much faster than if they were flush with warm blood. The sudden change to heat has the opposite effect. Veins suddenly pop open, and blood surges back into those cold areas, generating an excruciating wave of pain. Kuz stretches his feet towards the box of coals and confides that he is on the verge of tears. Lascelius clenches his teeth and holds his breath. A side effect of asthma, he tells me, is poor circulation, and the sensation of vasoconstriction is even more painful for him than it is for me. But I like to think of it as lifting weights for the circulatory system, he says. Hoff nods at the assessment. We aren't just warming our bodies, we are feeling new sensations. It is an early step to gaining control over them. After years of exposing himself to cold, Hoff says that he can now operate his veins much like he could his fingers. That is, he can consciously restrict the flow of blood to his limbs and send it to any other part of his body that he wants to. Although the first day of exercise is painful and exhausting, true to Hoff's word, our progress is rapid. The next day, we stand in the snow for 15 minutes before the same feeling of panic sets in. In the afternoon, we take a brief dip in the basin of an ice-cold waterfall that is a 5-minute walk from Hoff's back door. An hour passes by quicker than 5 minutes had just days earlier. In the evening, we sit on the snow-covered rocks by a stream until they are warm. With every attempt, the barriers that we've built in our minds around the cold recede a little further. By the fourth day, standing in the snow is barely a challenge. All the while, Hoff smiles over us like a Cheshire cat. What we know about how the human body reacts to cold comes mostly from gruesomely accurate studies that emerge from the Dachau death camp. Nazis tracked Jewish prisoners' core temperatures as they died in ice water. As terrible as they are, these morally compromised studies have helped doctors understand how quickly the body loses heat in such conditions. Sitting in 32-degree water, humans begin to feel sluggish after only a minute or two. By 15 minutes, most people fall unconscious. They die between 15 and 45 minutes, depending on their underlying physiology. When the core body temperature falls below 82 degrees, death is almost inevitable. Measured against that data set, Hoff seems to perform miracles. In 2007, at the Feinstein Institute for Medical Research on Long Island, Kenneth Kommler, a world-renowned expedition doctor who has worked on Everest, observed an experiment in which Hoff was connected to a heart and blood monitor and immersed in ice. At first, the experiment hit a major snag. The standard hospital devices that track respiration declared him dead after he'd only been in the ice for 2 minutes. The machine got confused because he hadn't taken a breath, and his resting heart rate was a mere 35 beats per minute. He wasn't dead, though, and Kommler had to disconnect the device to continue. Hoff stayed in the ice for 72 minutes. The results were astounding. Hoff's core temperature initially declined a few degrees, but then rose again. It was the first scientific validation of Hoff's method. Exactly how you explain it depends on the kind of philosophy you want to believe in, says Kommler when I track him down on the telephone. He references similar feats called tummo, performed by Tibetan monks, where they modulate their body temperature with breathing and intense visualizations of tantric deities. Ultimately, he says, it boils down to how Hoff uses his brain. The brain uses a lot of energy on higher functions that are not essential to survival. By focusing his mind, he can channel that energy to generate body heat, he speculates. Interest in Hoff among scientists snowballed in 2008, just as it had in the mass media about a decade earlier. Researchers at Maastricht University in the Netherlands wondered if Hoff's abilities stemmed from a high concentration of mitochondria-rich brown adipose tissue, also known as brown fat. This little-understood tissue can rapidly heat the body when it metabolizes its fuel source, ordinary white fat. Brown fat is what allows infants who don't have the muscles to warm themselves like most adults not succumb to the cold in their earliest months. Usually, brown fat disappears by early childhood, but evolutionary biologists believe that early humans may have carried higher concentrations of it to resist extreme environments. The scientists learned that Hoff, then 51, had built up so much brown fat over the course of his training that he could produce 5 times more heat energy than the typical 20-year-old, most likely because he repeatedly exposed himself to the cold. Brown fat may be the missing organic structure that separates humans from the natural world. White fat stores caloric energy from food, which the body tends to burn only as a last resort. In fact, it's difficult to burn the spare tire off your waistline because the body is programmed to store energy. Even during intensive exercise routines, the body will burn muscle before it uses white fat for energy. Brown fat is different. Most people create it automatically when they're in cold environments by way of a process called beiging. Essentially, the body detects physical extremes and starts to store mitochondria. When brown fat starts to work, the mitochondria suck white fat through the bloodstream and metabolize it directly to generate heat. Because most people do everything they can to avoid extreme environments, they never build up brown fat at all. However, if we lived without clothing the way our distant ancestors must have, then we would have to rely on the internal properties of brown fat to keep us alive during the winter months and cold nights. As we sit in the sauna, I ask Hoff how someone activates brown fat consciously. Instead of explaining, he launches into a demonstration. He clenches the muscles in his body in sequence, from his toes to his rectum, then from there up to his shoulders, as if pushing something up from below. Then he furrows his brow and squinches down his neck as though he's trapping that energy in a point right behind his ear. The process turns his skin bright red as if he's catching fire. Suddenly, he kicks out his leg and then falls against the wall, gasping. "Oh my God," he says, dazed. In his eagerness to teach, he didn't factor in the heat of the sauna and almost blew a fuse. He lurches out of the sauna and rolls in the snow outside. The few of us pupils exchange concerned glances, but in about 15 minutes he returns with an embarrassed smirk. "That's how you do it, but only try it in the cold." Hans Spanz, who was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease in 2004, credits Hoff with saving his life. When I first meet Hans in Poland, I discover that he has been trying the techniques for a little less than a year, mostly in private sessions with Hoff. "With this disease," he says, "most people have to take more and more drugs just to maintain the same level of mobility and quality of life. And eventually, you max out, and then you begin a long decline." Spanz is trying to manage his drug regime by accompanying it with Hoff's breathing technique and ice-cold showers. He tracks his drug use on spreadsheets and claims to be on far fewer drugs now than when he was first diagnosed. He credits Hoff with keeping him out of a wheelchair. And although such anecdotal evidence is encouraging, it's hard to determine the extent to which the benefits of the Hoff method can be chalked up to the placebo effect. Since Hoff claims to be able to control his own autonomic nervous system, which is one of the systems affected by Parkinson's, it is important to verify these claims through scientific study. Peter Pickers is just about the last scientist who would be swayed by outlandish claims. A research scientist at Radboud University Medical Center in the Netherlands and an expert on sepsis and infection, he specializes in the human immune system. In 2011, Hoff met Pickers and mentioned that he could suppress or ramp up his immune system at will, a feat that is, by definition, almost impossible. But Pickers, who had watched Hoff's career rise on TV, was curious. Pickers, along with his protege, a graduate student named Matthias Cox, who would go on to use this research as the basis for his PhD, devised a test in which they administered endotoxin, a component of E. coli bacteria, to the body. The body thinks that endotoxin is dangerous, even though it is actually inert. Picker's pioneering work proved that 99% of healthy people who come in contact with endotoxin react as though they have the flu before the body finally realizes that it has been duped and then returns to normal. The test has been used to figure out the effectiveness of certain autoimmune suppressant drugs, which are the sorts of pharmaceuticals that an organ transplant patient might take to stop the foreign tissue from being rejected. If a prospective drug stops patients from reacting to endotoxin, then it is a good indicator that the drug worked and is effective in turning off their immune systems. While Hoff meditated, Pickers and Cox injected him with endotoxin. The results were unheard of. Wim had done things that, if you had asked me prior to the experiment, I would not have thought possible, Pickers tells me. Whereas almost every other person dosed with endotoxin experiences severe side effects, Hoff had nothing more than a minor headache. Blood tests showed that he had much higher levels of cortisol, a hormone usually released only during times of extreme stress, sort of like adrenaline, than Pickers had ever recorded in any previous study. Also, blood drawn while he was meditating remained resistant to endotoxin for 6 days after it had left his body. Hoff is unambiguous when I ask him about the results. If I can show that I can consciously affect my immune system, then we will have to rewrite all of the medical books, he says. But Pickers and much of the rest of the scientific community are more reserved. While the results show an unprecedented response to endotoxin, it is maybe more likely that Hoff is just a genetic anomaly, the 1% of freaks who, for some reason, just don't react to endotoxin. Still, the results were promising enough for Pickers and Cox to commission a second study. In the upcoming experiment, Hoff will guide a group of college students through the same basic course that I am taking now before heading back to Pickers and Cox's lab for a good old-fashioned scientific prodding. If the technique proves to be teachable, then the ground could shift under Pickers' feet. The experiment will take place the week after I complete my own training, and I will have to wait more than a year to learn the results. For now, I will have to focus on a lone challenge that I have yet to complete, one that is just a little more daunting than a dip into a waterfall or lying in the snow. Despite my progress, I am not sure that I will be up for the grueling, bare-chested hike straight up the mountain. Mount Snezka straddles the Polish and Czech border and is battered by icy winds throughout the winter months. At its 5,259-foot summit, frequented mostly by intrepid cross-country skiers who hike up from a ski lift, a lonely observatory records the movements of the stars. We set out early in the morning, just as the sun sheds a few rays of light up into the sky. Starting at the base of the mountain, Hoff, three other disciples, and I begin the arduous climb through 2 feet of fresh powder. Seconds after we pile out of Hoff's dilapidated Volkswagen van, the cold slices through our winter coats. At 25 degrees Fahrenheit, the modest breeze feels excruciating. In the parking lot, skiers clad head to toe in colorful Gore-Tex ensembles wrestle with their gear and trek slowly to the chairlifts. Hoff leads us to a side trail that snakes through the parkland and to the summit. 10 minutes up the trail, after our bodies have had a little chance to build up some internal heat, we strip off the layers. Ashley Johnson, a former English hooligan who found new direction in life doing volunteer work around the Hoff House in exchange for lessons, slaps Lascelius and Coos on the back in camaraderie. Bare to the cold, we stash our clothes in our backpacks and crunch forward through the powder. The moment I take off my shirt, I start to get a sense of how our primordial ancestors would have handled the same march. Trudging forward, I don't feel the bite of the cold the way I did before undergoing the training. Whatever heat I build up through my exertion seems to stay in my skin. It's as if I'm wearing a wetsuit. I can feel the cold, but it never penetrates. I never shiver. Instead, I focus on the point behind my ears that Hoff says will activate my brown fat and send waves of heat through my body. I imitate what I witnessed Hoff do in the sauna. With my muscles clenched and my mind focused, it isn't long before I start to sweat. A thin, steamy mist wafts upward from the group. A skier stops to take pictures. A ski patrolman on a snowmobile pauses to see if we're okay. A snowboarder lets out a shocked cry and speeds by as we plod forward to the summit. The strangest thing is that we're not suffering at all. We are elated. Cold and exercise trigger an enormous endorphin release that paints a maniacal grin on my face. It is as if the temperature is subservient to the task ahead. 6 hours later, I near the summit, bare-chested, with my legs caked in snow. In just a week, I've gone from California palm trees to Poland's snowy peaks, and I feel perfectly warm. Hot, even. But it isn't over. The mountain is steep, and despite our effort, the progress is slow. Every step upward through the tree line leaves us incrementally more exposed than before. By afternoon, the outside temperature drops to just 8 degrees Fahrenheit, and at about 300 feet shy of the summit, something changes. My core temperature is fine, but the wind intensifies and the incline grows steeper. Every step feels harder than the one before it. I'm fatigued. And I begin to regret my lackluster gym habit. I worry about what might happen to me if I stop. Would the cold break through the mental barrier that I've erected and send me cascading into hypothermia? Fear, more than anything else, keeps me walking. This isn't the time to disprove the method. 20 minutes later, I reach the summit. Not cold, but more tired than I can ever remember being. We take a couple photos and I roll in the snow and marvel at how warm I feel. And then we step into the observatory together. Just like when I walked into the sauna after standing in the snowy field that first day at camp, the warm air of central heating sends a shock through my system. A minute earlier, I felt immune to the elements and happily cavorted in the snow. But now that I am out of harm's way and have begun to relax, I feel a new, creeping, cold sensation. My mental armor is gone and the ice leaks from my extremities into my bloodstream. Warm environments are supposed to make me feel warm, but that's not what is happening. Things are backward. At first, a small shiver escapes up my spine. A minute or two later, and it's a full-blown shake. My teeth clatter audibly, and soon I can't remember ever being this cold before in my entire life. This, I will learn later, is what paramedics who rescue hypothermic patients call afterdrop. During vasoconstriction, limbs get much colder than the core. When the body starts to warm up, it lets blood through the vascular system again. Blood chills as it passes through the cold arms, hands, and feet, and when it eventually circulates back to the heart, it lowers the body's overall core temperature. In extreme cases, afterdrop can be fatal. An hour elapses before I feel ready to get back on my feet and climb down the mountain. No longer focused enough to let my body resist the elements, I don the black peacoat that I brought up with me in my backpack. On the way back down, Hoff tells me that he wants to try to summit Mount Everest again. It will be his second time after his earlier aborted, nearly naked attempt. I ask Hoff what he thinks will happen if he finally reaches his limits on that climb and joins the hundreds who have died on the mountain. Would his message be lost to time? Would even the modest lessons that he has been able to give his flock mean anything if he dies in a way that most people would deem foolish? His face grows dark at the thought. He looks like he might cry. "I must not die," he says. "I've decided." The next day, Hoff brings me back to the airport in Wrocław. I feel a certain sense of accomplishment. The cold doesn't scare me anymore. In just 1 week, I had dropped almost 7 pounds of pure fat, a welcome side effect of repeatedly warming up my body. But what exactly had happened on Mount Snezca? Had I extended my abilities that had previously been locked away in an evolutionary dustbin? Or had I only lurched perilously close to the precipice of hypothermia? In other words, was I stronger, or did I just think that I was stronger? Had I merely delayed feeling cold until I started to warm up, only to put myself at serious risk from afterdrop? To answer these questions, it occurs to me that I will have to understand a little bit more about how we became human in the first place. Chapter 2: Raiding Evolution's Dustbin. In 1931, Arthur Fox, a chemist at the headquarters of the chemical company DuPont, was working in a laboratory with his partner, C.R. Noller, trying to make sense of a chemical that had the odd ability to turn fish skin transparent. The finely milled white powder was called phenylthiocarbamide, or PTC, by people who find seven-syllable words a mouthful. As Fox grabbed for the container of PTC, it slipped from his grasp and exploded onto the floor, filling the room with a giant white cloud. Chemical dust covered Fox. It coated his clothes and filled his mouth. In this moment, he was probably wondering if he might start to turn slightly translucent himself. Just a few feet away from him, his colleague, who was also caked in the powder, began to complain of an intensely bitter taste in his mouth. It was awful, he said. But Fox tasted nothing. Curious about the disparity in sensation, and apparently unfazed by the dangerous breach in safety protocol, Fox dipped his finger into the powder and deposited another glop onto his tongue. Nothing. Noller tried a second tab and grimaced at the bitter taste. This humble moment, which could have turned into a running practical joke between the two men, instead sparked a flurry of research into the discrepancies in the way that humans experience the world. Some of us, like Fox, can taste a normal array of things. But then there is a certain percentage of super-tasters like Noller, for whom Brussels sprouts are more obnoxious, lemons pucker-worthy, and salt more profoundly, well, salty. In the course of their subsequent investigation, they discovered that the difference in their taste sensitivity derived from an abnormally high number of mushroom-shaped taste buds on Noller's tongue. People like him, these super-tasters, account for about 25% of the population, and, for whatever reason, women are more likely to be super-tasters than men. While super-tasting does not have much of a profound effect on most people's daily lives, the existence of supertasters offers a peek into the strange world of sensory perception. Indeed, PTC sensitivity is far from the only recently discovered sense. There are people who can see more than 100 million colors. The normal human can distinguish about 2.4 million. It's an ability called tetrachromancy. There are people who have the ability of absolute pitch and are able to listen to a note on a piano and instantly recognize its frequency without needing another tone for reference. There are blind people who can navigate the world by clicking their tongues and listening to the echoes, an ability that they share with bats and dolphins. Some people's sensory hardware scrambles the inputs between the senses so that they can taste colors and hear smells, a condition called synesthesia. The neurological jumble usually doesn't interfere with synesthetes' daily lives, and indeed many go on to be extraordinarily successful and creative, from the author Vladimir Nabokov to the scientist Richard Feynman. While these super abilities don't always have an immediate application to life in the world we live in now, they offer underlying opportunities for evolution to take advantage of the mutations. Should the occasion present itself, there may be situations where tasting a wider array of chemicals or seeing more of the visual spectrum could affect a person's chances to reproduce and pass on their genes. Some of these abilities, like absolute pitch, can even be trained such that those possessing the gift can learn to pick out the notes of a song instantly as if they were reading them on paper. At birth, someone who has the mutation for absolute pitch might indeed have the raw potential to become an expert musician. But only with training and concentration can that individual hone the sense for optimal performance. Once trained, that inborn ability becomes perfect pitch, a skill and ability prized by musicians. But if left untrained, the musical ability can disappear with disuse like a vestigial tail, even when the underlying biology for absolute pitch is still present. A person with such a gift, but with no musical inclinations, could live their whole life without ever realizing the ability that they might have had. Indeed, it doesn't take much effort to find some abilities that our entire species is in the process of pushing to the wayside. A century and a half ago, the darkest corners of the world weren't only being explored, they were being exposed to the unstoppable progress of a global economic engine. After explorers reached the North Pole, the people after them brought general stores to the Arctic. Highways bisected impenetrable jungles, and air travel made every part of the planet reachable within hours. Today, getting from one remote island in the Pacific to another is literally as easy as booking a ticket online. Before all that, the world was incomprehensibly vast and unknowable to all but the greatest explorers. In the islands of the Pacific, solitary men grappled with the unfathomable distances of water around them. Yet they devised methods to navigate their way between islands in tiny canoes with only the stars and stories for guides. Without maps, Pacific Islanders paddled between habitable polka dots of land on journeys that could take weeks. Some anthropologists believe that they might have been able to cross the endless open water of the Pacific all the way to South America using nothing more than their own dead reckoning, possibly setting up small settlements in the Americas 10,000 years ago. While knowledge of the stars can orient sailors at night, weather conditions in the Pacific are rarely predictable enough to allow for the cloudless sky views needed to rely on that method alone. Indeed, Captain Cook, the most famous English explorer of the Pacific and the first European to circumnavigate New Zealand, achieved much of his success with the aid of a Tahitian chief who boarded his ship, the Endeavour. The chief, named Tupaia, sailed with the crew for almost 20 months and used his memories of the waters to help Cook create a map of 130 islands along a 2,500-mile swath of ocean. Much to Cook's astonishment, no matter where the Endeavour traveled, and despite turbulent conditions, dark of night or the stillness of a featureless day, Tupaia could always point to the direction of his home island. Tupaia was a wave pilot, who could read the minute signatures that land leaves on ocean currents, something he called dillep. Cook, who had the aid of a Royal Navy compass, recorded in his account of his trip that Tupaia was never once wrong with his directional sense. Back in the time of the Endeavour, Captain Cook landed on the northern tip of Queensland, Australia. There he found an Aboriginal group called the Gugu Yimithir and decided to create a codex of their language. Among the words he wrote down were kangaroo and their word for ocean. He remarked at how different the language sounded to his ear than every other language he had ever heard in the Pacific. Most interestingly, the Gugu Yimithir had developed such a sense of direction that when they described the location of things, it was always in terms of the cardinal directions. They had no words for right, left, front, or back. If you sat down next to a Gugu Yimithir tribesman at dinner, you wouldn't be on their right side. You'd be to the west, or east, or north, or south. This undoubtedly made Cook's cross-cultural dinner party a confusing affair, if also an interesting anthropological moment. Despite not putting themselves at the center of their language, these Aborigines could talk and communicate their orientation even if they were enclosed in a room, or without lights. Knowing where they were was simply second nature. Today, the anthropological research on their language is all but extinct. The tribesmen are mostly scattered to the wind or have become victims of centuries of persecution. Tupaia, and many indigenous people for that matter, had an innate sense of special orientation that is all but non-existent in modern society. But there is reason to believe that this latent sense, termed wayfaring by anthropologists, is something that many people still have biologically hardwired. In the 1970s, a biologist at the University of Manchester in England named Robin Baker attempted to test a theory that some humans, like birds, are able to sense direction through the use of an innate cellular compass. The theory was that humans have magnetically sensitive cells in their nasal bones and eyes that can feel the pull of the magnetic poles in the same way that a compass needle always points north. Baker decided to test the idea by tying magnets to the heads of healthy college male volunteers in order to reorient any magnetic cells to the local interference. He tied non-magnetic brass bars to the heads of his control group, and then drove his blindfolded test subjects into the English wilderness. There he asked them to point the way home. In his groundbreaking findings, he reported that the non-magnetized students could point the way home with a significantly higher degree of accuracy than the others. The research set off a flurry of subsequent research, not all of which was able to replicate Baker's results. Other magnet-tying tests failed. However, after many contentious debates carried out over the course of a decade, researchers reached a consensus that whether the cause was magnetism or some other underlying aspect of biology, humans do, indeed, have an innate directional sense. It's just that we don't use it very much anymore. For anyone whose lifespan encompasses the transition from the analog 1990s into the hyper-connected 2000s, the loss of innate wayfaring is easy to recognize. In my teens and 20s, the only way to learn a new city was to get familiar with maps. One of my first jobs ever was as a door-to-door fundraiser for an environmental group that promised good money if I could convince householders to cough up cash for a campaign that would shut down polluting power plants around the Boston area. The summer job spoke to both my perpetually empty wallet and my latent desire to do something good for the environment. After a few weeks, I rose to the position of field manager, which meant I was in charge of coordinating a summer's worth of door knocking for a crew of canvassers. Budgets and time were tight, and the crews had to work as efficiently as possible. I color-coded a paper map of my patch of the city, the suburb of Somerville. It took just a few days before I knew every alley, dead end, and thoroughfare of the city's incomprehensible web of streets. Constantly reviewing the spatial information in front of me, as well as guessing likely routes between pickup and drop-off points, helped me internalize the entire city. Name a street, and I knew precisely how to get there. And then, a few years later, came the digital revolution. Sometime in late 2009, around the same time that I moved from Brooklyn, New York to Long Beach, California, I bought a digital map that suction cupped to the windshield of my car. Up until that moment, I'd missed the smartphone sea change, and I was entranced by how this little device allowed me to enter an address and follow step-by-step in-the-moment directions to plan my way across a new city. The paper map that had brought me on the road trip across the country gathered dust in my trunk, and I used the TomTom every time I got in the car. Every turn was a carefully choreographed digital prompt. 6 months later, I could barely make it across town without it. My dependence on the device led me on some ill-advised wild goose chases. Once, a digital hiccup took me 50 miles out of my way on a trip to do an interview on the other side of Los Angeles. I lost my directional sense after just a few short months of depending on a digital knickknack. Like most people who use their phones to ping their GPS coordinates off mobile phone towers, I had outsourced my wayfaring abilities from my brain, and also maybe those tiny magnets in my nose and eyes, to an electronic gizmo. Culture and technology overtook my biology. A recent study of cab drivers in London offers a glimpse into how wayfaring corresponds to specific brain structures. In order to get their taxi permit, London cab drivers have to memorize the convoluted rat's nest of English streets and be able to navigate the entire metropolis without maps. Researchers hooked up cabbies to MRI machines and discovered that the longer they drove cabs, the larger the volume of their hippocampi increased. The finding proved that thinking spatially can drastically change the brain. However, and perhaps more interesting, is that once the drivers retired, their brain structures returned to ordinary sizes. It's strange to think about how quickly a human sense can disappear when it falls into disuse. Even when it is the most defining characteristic of a person, simply not exercising the neural muscle over a short time can make someone entirely dependent on external resources. While digital maps are a fairly recent phenomenon, there are other, much more fundamental biological abilities that have simply vanished from our everyday use altogether. They lie there dormant and unused until the right stimulus wakes them up. Some abilities stem from the deepest recesses of our animal past, from a time before our species walked upright. Perhaps before our amphibious ancestors even crawled out of the water for good. The story of the discovery of animal responses to water starts in 1894, when a physiologist named Charles Rickett began tying up ducks so tightly with twine that they couldn't work their lungs anymore. The rather sadistic experiment could have been a plot point in a horror story, but it was actually an attempt to understand how water affects a duck's central nervous system. In a series of experiments that must have decimated the local duck population, Rickett learned that the average duck can survive for about 7 minutes without breathing when on dry land. However, when Rickett submerged the duck in cold water, the duck lived for almost 22 minutes before expiring. Somehow, the sensory stimulus of being in water had suppressed the doomed duck's metabolism. But it wouldn't be until 1962 that anyone tried any similar test on humans. Luckily for the human subjects of the Swedish-born physiologist Per Sjölander, testing methods had gotten a little more sophisticated over the intervening century. Indeed, instead of binding his volunteers to death, he used lab equipment to measure the heart rates and oxygen levels of volunteers while they dove to the bottom of a pool. The second that the cool water covered their faces, Sjölander noticed an immediate and corresponding decrease in their heart rates. It was the same phenomenon that Rickert had seen with his ducks. In the second phase of the experiment, Sjölander installed a few pieces of fitness gear at the bottom of the pool and told his subjects to work out while they were underwater. While the toil of lifting weights underwater must have been awkward, the heart monitors showed that no matter how vigorous their activity was, their heart rates remained suppressed. Not only that, the volunteers also experienced vasoconstriction while beneath the surface of the water as the blood flowed from their extremities, shunted toward their core. The water, it turned out, triggered a series of physical changes in his subjects that advantageously prepared them to survive in hostile underwater environments where breathing would mean death. It's a reflex that Sjölander named the master switch of life, a term that has since been taken up by a burgeoning freediving community that depends on these built-in changes in the body to extend the duration of their underwater forays. Freedivers, described masterfully in James Nestor's book Deep, are able to rapidly descend hundreds of feet below the ocean's surface and then come up without risking the dangers of decompression that scuba divers have to worry about. As they dive, the pressure of the water collapses their lungs while the cold subdues their oxygen consumption. A world champion freediver can descend as much as 1,000 feet and still come back to the surface alive and unharmed. In 2012, one freediver managed to hold his breath for a mind-boggling 22 minutes underwater during a competition. Footnote: readers, beware. Some methods found in this book can help a person hold their breath for a very long time, but the techniques are not appropriate for use in deep water. The Wim Hof method carries a small chance of unexpected fainting, which is safe enough on dry land, but not so much in the water. In addition, even proper freediving techniques can be dangerous. Between 2006 and 2011, 308 freedivers died in the course of training and competition. This water-triggered master switch also has uses for landlubbers suffering from anxiety attacks or heart arrhythmia. If you happen to be prone to panic attacks, then submerge your face in ice water at the peak of the attack. This will signal your body to prepare for going underwater and disrupt the heart palpitations. It's not easy to know how many vestigial responses like these lay dormant deep within our human physiology. They are the sorts of abilities that only manifest themselves when the right conditions arise. They are the gift of millions of generations of incremental biological changes from ancestors whose daily challenges we only have a dim understanding of. Because most humans nowadays live within a narrow band of homeostasis, unlocking new responses occurs mostly by chance. And yet, when they do trigger, we are not always conscious enough to notice how they kicked in. In the modern world, there are almost no people who are truly untouched by civilization. There's no control group that scientists can reference for what a wild human might actually be like. Instead, the best we can do is to rely on early anthropological literature, first contact reports, and the mythologies and oral histories of native people around the world. One story that I'm particularly fond of, even if it's also enigmatic, is the story of the last Apache warrior who stood up against the onslaught of Western civilization. After quashing the Confederacy in the Civil War, the Union Army turned its attention toward the Arizona Territory, where a small band of Native Americans were ambushing settlers and small military units. By the mid-1860s, most of the Apache had already been rounded up and placed into the camps that would eventually become the reservation system. But one particularly angry warrior named Geronimo resisted. He led a small band of fighters on a deadly campaign of bloody revenge for the atrocities committed against his people. Shutting down this renegade became a top priority for officials in Washington. They committed 5,000 soldiers to the effort. They installed a revolutionary technology called the helograph, a precursor to the telegraph that transmitted Morse code via flashes of light, to coordinate the campaign. And yet, despite what was effectively the largest manhunt in history, Geronimo's career extended through almost 30 years of violent conflict, only until he eventually surrendered on his own terms when he was in old age. In that time, he never had the advantage of numbers or technology, living instead by his wits and luck alone. Some historians record that his party killed as many as 5,000 people. The Apache credit Geronimo's success to divine favor. They believe the god Usen granted him a special power that they called enemy against. It let him know where his enemies were at all times. With it, he could predict the weather and was said to be almost cosmically in tune with the world around him. While Geronimo's successes are a rare example of indigenous triumph over the juggernaut of Western progress, there are many tales of native healers and shamans who displayed similar abilities. The nomadic reindeer herders of Norway, the Sami, were said to be able to communicate telepathically with one another over impossible distances. Similar feats show up in certain Aboriginal groups in Australia and among various South American tribes. Whether any of these are innate human abilities or instead the things that fall under the purview of faith and religion is anyone's guess. Rigorous scientific studies of so-called psychic abilities have almost universally failed at proving the seemingly supernatural claims. That